humorous incidents.
About well, you know, it sure didn't seem humorous at the time, but I can't remember exactly where we were at. I think it was near the Red Beach area. We had an operation going, and we had moved into this village, and we were, you know, around some of the villages. They would make trenches for local support and local defense, and we were in their trenches when we started taking some fire, and the village was near water and everything else, vegetation and plantation, and there were cobras, you know, in the area, and everybody was talking about, you know, if you get bit by a king cobra or this or that, you know, you got 3 seconds, and don't light up a cigarette, don't conduct a long conversation, and, you know, do this and don't do that. So this is all I've heard, is that, you know, if a cobra gets near me, I'm in 3 seconds later, I'm not going to be anywhere to be worried about. So during this firefight, this trench line is a circular thing, and I look down and I see guys getting out of the trench, and I'm thinking, you know, they were getting out to the rear, and then they'd get right back in. I thought, well, are we going to advance, or, you know, are we going to sit here, are we going to get out and go to the rear, or what? And then the guy closer to me, he would get out of the trench, and then he'd get back right back in. And then all of a sudden, I could hear what they would be yelling something. And as it finally got close to me, I could hear the guy that yelled next to me. He says, "Snake," and you know, that's just a snake. And I looked down, and here come a cobra. And I thought, you know, he's damn right, it's a snake, okay. And just like everybody else, I got out of the hole, and when he went by, I got back into the hole. And he continued on down, and apparently he'd made that run, you know, I don't know how many times in the snake's life, and, you know, he wasn't going to be bothered by us or anybody. And we had one old boy on a lookout. We provided security for a naval forward auxiliary unit. They were FOs for the Bonhomie Richard or some of those type ships. And this guy got beat up by a rockade. He was back in his bunker, and we were in the Highlands at the time, and, you know, the fog and everything would move up, and down in our concertina we would put, you know, that okay ration ham, it's salty, dog. Well, you know, we would take a couple of smells of it, and that would satisfy our appetite, and we'd just throw it down in there. Well, we did that, and you know, we started attracting these rockades, and so here's a brand new security force. Us, we get up there, and you know, this is like night one or two or something like that, and this is what these guys offer us to eat: this K rations, and we're thinking, you know, God, you know, we'll stick to our C's, and we're throwing all this garbage down in there because the cans, they make good. Prior warning devices, and we hear clanging on the wire, fogged in completely, socked up, and there's you know, maybe a squad of us plus four FOs, so there's maybe 15 people there, 15 people in the middle of the Vietnam jungle on a hilltop, fog all around you. And we're taking some movement on the wires, and it's really getting intense, you know. And so we decided, you know, we waited for a while. We said, you know what, you know, we call in artillery. Let's not shoot our personal weapons, because then they'll know we're up here. Let's not shoot any automatic weapons for sure. Maybe a grenade. Maybe call in smoke flares. A command decision by the officers and everything were required, and this and that. We called in some artillery on our own position. And we went down there, and we had killed a bunch of rock apes. So everybody was thinking, you know, wow, God, this is really something. So a couple nights later, we're asleep, and we've done some repair work to the damage of our wire. But it's feasible that somebody could penetrate it anyway. But we knew where that area was. Raining and really cold and everything, and we lived, I guess, just like rock apes did. We would dig a hole back into the mountain, and you could live as comfortably as, you know, home was where you dug it, and you could dig as comfortably as you dug the hole in the ground. And so I had just gone on watch and relieved my bunker buddy in there, and he went inside to go to sleep. He laid his weapon at the entrance to the hole, and he went back and fell asleep. And a damned rock ape. Rock ape is just like a baboon. Just like a baboon. And they are strong, bud. They are strong. And this rock ape, he was looking for shelter too, or someplace, you know, warm, and get out of the mist and the clouds and fog and stuff, sleep. And he crawls back in this hole, in our hole, with this guy. And he wakes up seeing this gorilla, or, you know, a rock ape, and it scared the daylights out of him. And every time he'd move, this old rock ape would beat the daylights out of him, beat him with his fists, his feet, and he'd bite him a couple times and everything. And finally, we lured him out with some more of this rancid, salty K-ration ham and stuff. And he would eat it, and we were thinking about shooting him. Someone says, when the animal comes out, says, we can see him, you want to shoot him? And we decided that we'd better not, because if we just wounded him, he'd go back in and he'd kill the guy, or, you know, really hurt him pretty bad, because he, you know, he'd be hurt then. So we just fed him all the way back down the hill and went inside and got this old boy and medevaced him, because he was in shock. it put him in shock. He had some, you know, multiple bruises and like dog bite wounds, punctures and things on him. I never knew that things could be that bad, you know, just sleeping. Yeah, even when you're asleep, you know, you wake up and there's a gorilla in the hole with you. But, you know, that, to us, that seemed kind of funny. And we dressed up a guy like a Playboy bunny on the same hole. And we were relieved we were pulled off that hill after that. They thought we'd all gone nuts. Playboy magazine and everything, and the Key Club deal was the big thing during that time.
Yeah, the more you can say about the Playboy, the more I'd appreciate, because we're going to have a section dealing with Playboy, people reading Playboys.
This is what this article in this big newspaper clipping in this thing was about. I had a little deal about that.
Why don't you start over on the Playboy? Lead back into it.
This is where we were on the same observation post. And we had daily resupplies by our Marine Air Wing. The CH-47s would fly in, and they would deliver mail to us and food. And we even got some hot beer. I think we got some of that Falstaff and hams, you know, just ham on garbage. And candy. They were bringing us candy bars. And so this was, you know, something that would really... The height of our day, you know, every other day or something like that, would be to greet this helicopter and the pilot. And we got to be knowing these guys after a while. They'd fly up there and say, you know, hey, how's everything? How's the war going? And so we figured, someone brought them a magazine, Playboy magazine. And I think Jo Collins was the, is that her name? Jo Collins was the playmate. And she made Playmate of the Year that year. So there was a little something to do about the Key Clubs in there, and everybody gets an idea. They say, let's tear out, or let's make a key out of a case, sea rations, a little cardboard, make a cardboard key. And let's get a bunny. And the next time these guys fly in, we'll offer them the exclusive key to Hill 591. And everybody prepared for this thing, and we says, who's going to be the bunny? Who's going to give it to him? And, you know, there was almost a fist fight over that. It was, oh, God, boy. You know, because, see, we had a whole day to go and either select, coerce, threaten, or, someone volunteer as to who's going to be the bunny and present this key to these pilots. And, so finally, this old boy, he's funnier than heck. He's just a crazy guy anyway. He says, okay. He says, I'll do it. And he says, but no pictures. And this was his condition. He says, don't take no pictures of me because, you know, I'm a Marine and, you know, macho everything. He says, well, you guys ever take a picture and I'll kill every one of you. So everybody says, yeah, no pictures. We promise no pictures. So we made a bikini out of a sandbag. We cut him a little, you know, canvas. One, it must have been terrible to wear. You know, made him a little bikini and a bikini top out of a sandbag, you know. And the bikini top was just, you know, we made it round and the whole bit and everything. Like, he had something there. And cardboard ears, made him the cardboard ears out of the sea ration case with some, the, you know, the wire that you use for the deal. We made him a bow tie. You know, bow tie was out of the, you know, you got sea ration toilet tissue and the whole bit. And we almost used up all of our sea ration toilet paper, which was a very high priority item for his tail. We used all that paper for his little tail. We made him a tail, the whole bit, cuffs out of the cardboard and everything. And we used our mat board marks a lot, made it all black, you know, a little bow tie, his little cuffs black and everything. And, his little tray, we had a tray out of a sea ration cardboard box. And so they radioed us, here they come, the big day. And normally when we meet them, everybody's standing outside the bunkers waving at them, hi guys, you know, and they circle and they come on in, directly, straight in, because the LZ is right there made for them. So we call them and everybody's hiding this time. It's going to be a little something different. We got some empty beer cans and this key and everything's right there. This poor schmuck, he's gonna, you know, he's hiding that in there too. And God, it was terrible there because at the last second, he's fixing to go Berkshire on us and forget the whole deal. And we said, no, no pictures. There's no one's got any cameras. And so here comes the helicopter, and he doesn't see everybody out there waving at him. And he's thinking, you know, uh-oh. So he just cuts a chogi right over the top of our hill. And he makes a cut, and he disappears behind the mountain. When he's behind the mountain, he calls us again. He says, hey, what's going on down there? He says, where's everybody at? We says, oh, hey, we're here. We're just, you know, we're trying to get out of the heat today. He says, okay. He says, we'll get somebody up the topside. He says, I want to see you. And, you know, he's thinking, you know, something worse has happened. So here he comes, you know, one of the guys up there, you know, come on in. And as he's landing, here comes this guy out with this thing, and, you know, pilots don't normally do this, but this old boy shut his helicopter down on top of this hill, and he gets out. He rolled out. They all fell out for this thing. He says, oh, my God. He says, you guys, you're crazy and everything else. He says, leave you alone for 2 days and whatever. So we welcomed him. We gave him some hot beer and some candy bars. That's, you know, really all we had. And, you know, he was the exclusive first member, first key of Key Club member to Hill 591 over there. And, you know, I guess what had happened is when he went back, he, you know, says, hey, I got a funny thing happened to me today. You know, here I see this Marine dressed up like a bunny. Give me the key. He took it all with him, see. And he tells the story around, and we got pulled off this old hill. They thought, These old boys have been up there too long, because we had been up there for quite some time. And they pulled us right off the old mountain, and, you know, everything was rosy for us. So, you know, we got to drink milk and the whole bit after that. So you guys need anything? That's crazy.
That's hilarious. I got moved off the hill, but it wasn't for a funny reason. How about, we've been going for quite a while here. Let me ask you something about, what was the general feeling toward the, you know, as you looked up the chain of command, did they know what they were doing?
Yeah.
Did the, you know, guy out in the line, did he feel as though people up the chain of command knew what they were doing? Or was he being moved around for stupid reasons? Well, see, one of the reasons why I ask you this is many, many news reports, the reporter go up to a Marine and say, listen, this thing's all fouled up, isn't it? And, you know, try to get the guy to complain or grouse about the command structure.
Well, you know, we had a problem there at Quezon with those M16s. They were brand new with them jamming up and stuff like that at the time. And, you know, I think that probably this is where we vented all of our, you know, our anger was at, you know, weapons malfunctioning on us. But as far as I'm concerned, I would be sure that the rest of the, you know, the grunts probably felt the same way as it. You know, we could look at our leader, which would be, you know, our CO, and his expertise in small unit tactics or in company size tactics, which this was Captain Sheehan, was his name, by the way. And later it was Captain O'Brien. But Sheehan was there with us on Quezon. And, you know, I sensed that he was aware that we were doing something that could become possibly a part of Marine Corps history, you know, or a decisive battle. And I felt that, you know, that feeling was handed down to everybody. You know, the PFCs, the new guys, the privates and everything else like that. And we knew right away that, you know, this was not going to be a cakewalk. And, you know, they told us when we started out on the thing that we'd probably have, you know, a couple of reinforced divisions. And this for a battalion to tackle is something that, you know, you think, oh my God, you know, this can't be done when you're looking at the numbers, figures. And so I remember seeing at Quezon when we were dragging either Golden or Corporal Dye back after having been shot and wounded, I remember looking back up on that saddle, which is where everybody was getting seriously wounded, and seeing Sheehan and the radio operator still talking. He was talking on the radio. And, you know, I thought, you know, Jesus Christ, he's, you know, the CO's crazy for being, you know, up there, knowing that these guys are getting shot and everything else like that. But, you know, then later you realize that the information that he is handing out to whoever he's got to report to, you know, is going to be probably saving somebody's life. And you know, the leadership there was good. I'm not saying because I love the Marine Corps or anything else like that, but the men that were there at Quezon with me did an exceptional job to the man. You know, even those that were killed, you know, I mean, what more sacrifice could you give at the time? During Quezon, I personally knew the only Medal of Honor winner that I, you know, that I've ever known is just one of the guys, and it was Anderson, PFC Anderson. He was a black kid, and he smothered a grenade with his body, and Anderson was in Foxtrot Company. 2-3. You know, you were seeing that kind of thing done daily at Quezon, and it just seems that, you know, it doesn't that didn't get reported, or, you know, we knew at the time that we were involved in something that was you know, it had to become a major action at one time or another. And then when we saw Moshe Dayan come to the mountain, and that was kind of a joke, you know, going around there, you know, and, you know, Muhammad come to the mountain finally. And, you know, the first question is, you know, here comes CBS News, here comes Moshe Dayan, here comes a lot of brass to see what we had done. And then we knew that we were involved in a pretty spectacular battle. Then they told us the numbers figure, you know, a battalion versus a couple of divisions. And Diane was there to see and study the air and ground assault combination, because this is what he was going to take home to his country, and subsequently he was going to have his war, but that sucker would only last for 7 days, and he was going to use, you know, the Marine Corps tactics to do it with. And we, you know, we felt like, you know, that was something to be proud of. This guy comes to study us, you know, us in particular, and so it, you know, it must be a major combat action. you know, even if just to get him involved along with the news media and everything, because, you know, when the news media show up, we figured, you know, that was really something.
Okay, let me ask you now about you can, you know, cut into this any way you want. We ever did any newspaper people or television reporters ever question you?
No.
Talk to you? Okay. When you came, you might want to talk something about, well, when you returned and saw the war on TV, was there something missing in the portrait? I guess that's the way I'd like to phrase it for you then. You came back here at a certain point, the war is still going on, you're seeing the war on TV. I know in my case, I saw a couple of friends, you know, on the screen, being carried out, medevaced, and so on. What about your reflections on how TV portrayed the war?
Well, you know, at the time it was, you know, whenever I would see it on TV, and I was very interested in it, very interested in it. Every time that there was something on TV, I would go to look. If I had prior knowledge, I'd be there when it was on. And it just seemed like that the television representation that I was seeing after I got back from Vietnam made me feel more remote from the war than I had been. And, you know, I don't know if I can explain it or not. I just felt like, you know, I had been there and I'd done some of the things that I knew that they were trying to get to the heart of, but it just seemed like it didn't get there to me, because maybe they didn't talk to, all you would see was, you know, a newsman and a general, a newsman and a colonel, a newsman and some type of field grade commanding officer. And it's a general, how's the war going? You know, and you've got to have politics involved with you know, the generals and things like that, and they've got to say it's going stupendous. And we're killing more of them than they are of us, and that's great.
If you can believe that.
That is fanatical. That is fanatical.
First tee of a golf course.
The first tee?
Yeah.
I wonder why they didn't choose 18.
Yeah. Well, it's because it's a start rather than the finish, I guess. Okay, listen, we're getting back to seeing the war on television. You were saying that newsmen frequently spoke to high-level officers and maybe didn't get the word.
Yeah, you know, they were, you know, they would report that everything is going well because of the, you know, the numbers and what have you of we're killing more of them than they are of us. And to me, the things that seemed important might not have been important, you know, to them, like clothing and food and ammo. Although, you know, we never had any problems with it, other than, say, the clothing, you know, you could see it rotting off of you and everything else like that. And it seemed like, you know, everybody had dysentery and, you know, intestinal problems, always eating chalk or charcoal or something. And
anything else left out?
Yeah, you just, you know, you did feel left out, you know, like, how scared were you today, as opposed to how scared were you today, General? And I'm sure that if you got two people, a grunt and that general up there, and you ask them that question, you'd probably get a very colorful graphic description from the snuffy, or from the private, or from the machine gunner. And then from the general, you know, it would be a very mundane thing. That's because that's his job. His job is to, you know, administratively conduct the war. And he's got to be separated from it, because you don't want your generals in combat. But to me, if the reporting of war, of something like that, you ought to get out the feelings of the people that are involved with the actual conflict itself, because there's where you're going to get your opinion, to make up yourself, whether or not the damn thing's worth it or not. You know, whether you're really fighting for those people over there, whether you're fighting because you happen to see a Marine that was killed, you're fighting for, you know, the American way of democratic life, or you're fighting because you don't want to see communism imposed upon a people that's trying to be democratic. If they really want it, that's why you're there.
Let me ask you, do you think at all that the newspaper men were perhaps unsympathetic toward the war and then reported it accordingly, slanted the news, reported the worst rather than the best? Or do you think they were doing honest, direct job of reporting facts?
I think that primarily they were doing it, you know, the best that they could do. But I can see that the news reports that we got about Vietnam would not be the same news reports, even from the same people that reported them, if they were done today. Because I feel that there is a difference in how reporting is handled today as opposed to the way it was done back then. I think that it's really a cause of Watergate, because you have the reporter now that is keyed towards investigative reporting, getting down to that heart of the matter, you know, wanting to find out the whys and the mechanics of what caused something to happen, such as, you know, Watergate. And reporters today are, and I'm not sliding those people back in that period of time, but you know, reporters today, I think, would give you a more graphic and better report as a total of the war.
Okay, let me ask you to recount, if you would, this anecdote about the Vietnam Veterans Day. When you went to camp, kind of describe what the situation was. You went to
weekend drill.
Weekend drill, yeah.
I'm still in the Army National. I changed branches. I joined the Army National Guard because after being medevac so many times, I was awed by the pilots and the air crewmen, and I always wanted to be one. I guess, you know, I felt real highly of those guys. So I joined the Army National Guard and got into the aviation section out here. And come to find out, it's made up of, you know, a large percentage of Marines. And last Veterans Day, just following that, we had a weekend drill. And when I arrived there for the first time that Saturday morning, everybody was standing around talking, and all the Marines got together, and we were sure that somebody was going to comment on Veterans Day, because the military and Veterans Day and everything, and it just started going around. And when it first hit me, people were saying, hey, this is War Criminal Day for all the war criminals that were, goddamn Vietnam. It's funny. It was funny at the time, and everybody, we started laughing. And these right now, we're talking about 30-year-old men. We're not talking about the 19-year-old guys that were there at the time. And, we'd laugh about it for about a minute or two. And then all of a sudden, it would come time where just like in Vietnam, these 19-year-old kids would laugh about something, and then they'd get back to the seriousness of war. We'd laugh about it, War Criminal Day, ha-ha. And then the first thing that was said by everybody is, no shit. Which sums it all up, as in, no kidding. This is how they view it. This is how the world views it. This is how our country views it and everything else. Just, big deal. And it's, that just sums it all up.
Well, why? I mean, the question is it not possibly the case that the news had something to do with Americans having this impression?
You know, your famous journal once said, polish the heels of your boots very highly, because the last impression is the one that will be remembered of you the most. And as a man watches your heels going away, you'll know that you're pretty squared away. I feel also that the last impression of the Vietnam War, the last reporting incidents of the Vietnam War, are the ones that the people will remember highly. 67, when I was there at Quezon, they were just started the machinery of news reporting back to the United States, in depth and what have you. And they would send a news reporter over there for an in depth interview of your hometown guys. Well, by that time, they had to go beyond the 1967 reporting. They had to do better, because news media is no different than anybody else. They have to make themselves better, and they have to progressively do new things in the field of reporting attempts. And I think when the Cali incident came down on Malai, and then they had started having the investigative things and the, you know, let's go looking for atrocities. And then it just, you know, it just all ballooned. And it, you know, I know, you know, and every God blessed buddy that was over there knows that maybe it happened by our people to their people. But we damn sure know that it happened by those people to American soldiers.
Could you give an example at Quezon?
Quezon, there was a one. I just hope that the family doesn't know where this guy was killed at. But a 19 Antos platoon had been a 19 took a real heavy loss and beating up there. Okay, so this, they just stumbled in there, and this is what opened it up. And when we went up there to recover them and to start this battle off, we saw dead Marines. And looking for the platoon leader, the only way that we could find out that this guy was, or this body was the platoon leader, was that his torso, no head, no arms, no legs, had his lieutenant bars stuck in it. And his testicles, private parts, weren't on him either. And I'm very sure that a gunshot wound or a artillery round or a grenade blast didn't cause that. He was deliberately.
Well, the reaction to this sort of thing by the troops.
Yeah. Out of being shocked, you know, you're surprised at first. You don't know what the hell you're really looking at when you see a corpse that's been done like that. And then you start to wonder what's that in his chest. And then you start to realize, and you're angry. There's no, if you're not angry, then hell, you're probably not alive. And if there would have been one there, an enemy soldier, I'm sure that he would have probably paid the same consequences for the act of some other enemy soldier. And your whole attitude toward life changes. You know, here I am, and I appreciate clean water now. I appreciate going up to a drinking fountain, punching a button, and getting not only clean water, but it's cool. You know, over there, your values and everything are changed. Food is a basic necessity. You have it to go. You're just a machine to fight and to kill. And it doesn't say anything about Marcus of Queensbury rules. It does say Geneva rules, which we feel like, we've got to live by. They don't. So, you know, what the hell? And it just comes down to an eye for an eye type of feeling among the people that we're actually fighting. And if you get shot at, you know, our outfit, I don't know if there was an investigation actually done, but they were talking about one. We had like 20 some odd major operations in a very short time. This is one battalion landing team. And, you know, this puts everybody in a hard-pressed situation. You know, you go back to the ship just to be issued new clothing, and a week later you pull into another area to fight. So there's very little time there that you would, you know, you'd have true relief. And, you know, how many days can a guy go hearing the crack of bullets, the whizzing of bullets going by his face, you know, hearing bombs? You know, you can hear the steel being ripped off of a 155 round, 175, and 105 round. You can distinguish when the steel starts tearing apart what round that is, you know. And a guy shouldn't be placed in there. You can smell blood. You know, you can smell the enemy if you're close enough. You can smell when there's a decaying body as opposed to a decaying water buffalo that's been killed. You can smell the rot of your own skin from immersion foot. And after a while, things such as body odor itself is really undistinguishable as to underarm spray or something like that, because then you smell like just like the dirt, just like the terrain and stuff like that. And then at Quezon, I will never forget the smell there while we were moving. You know, they used an awful lot of napalm, and you could smell that fuel along with, you know, the dead bodies, decaying bodies and things like that. And if you can remember being around the dead bodies and smelling that smell, it smells the real pungent garlic sweet odor. And from the time that we entered Quezon to the time that I left, we smelt that. That's what we smelled every single day. With the exception of every great once in a while, you know, you could smell smoke from the weapons and things like that, which only, you know, intensified that garlic sweetness smell, just a real real pungent odor. And
could you say something about the napalm, you know, what it would look like? See, we're going to use a lot of footage of that sort of thing. Close air support.
Yeah, I'll show you some close air support. There's a bunch of guys that I don't see how those people could have this case on here. Yeah.
How are we doing on that, Midge?
Just a tiny bit left.
Oh, really?
Time goes by, doesn't it? I think I've got some of those little cassettes if you need.
Oh, I've got more.
I don't see how those guys got so close without, you know, stacking them.
I know. I think those pilots are crazy.
They were amazing.
Some of the Vietnamese pilots were pretty good, too.
Oh, yeah. Countryside was kind of pretty over there.
Well,
Duncan really captured some good photographs of
you're further along here. I think you're getting in there.
Yeah. Because this is down here by the base.
No, that's a marvelous collection. And we'll use some of these. We're going to interview him if we can.
You remember how you come down into that thing when you're flying along in a damn caribou, and all of a sudden just you get down in quick and get it. Home is where you dig it. Right there. Here's where they're starting.
Okay, what page are we on?
206. It's a fold out. You know, seeing these old bombs pickled and everything.
Okay.
It's, there's something. You're going in. This right here really doesn't show you how close, you know, they are to the. Now, here, this does. You know that it's just right there. It looks like, you know, This is just better than a drive-in movie. And it's happening right there. And this old boy is really not that far off the deck, because that land is coming to a slope like this. Those old Phantom pilots, boy, they were super duper. Check this out. Rockets down in there. That's something else. 130. There's his support chopper.
Anything else about this, close air support or your experience with it?
You know, you can't say enough for it, but then again, you can't put into words your feeling of having it there when you need it. Close air support. I don't see how anybody could have a war. You know, I mean, that may sound funny, but I don't see how anybody could have a war that they wanted to win and not use close air support. The ground troops serve their purpose, and close air support serves their purpose. It's like you can't drive a car without having fuel. Well, ground operations can't conduct their part without air. And
did you have experience with napalm being used on a hilltop ahead of you, or
oh yeah,
around your position? Maybe you could describe that.
Caisson. You know, we would. I think we had some Navy pilots and A-7s that came into Caisson, and they were dropping. You'd see the big long silver cylinders of napalm. You'd think, you know, that they were wing tanks. And we'd watch these old boys, these crusaders, come in, and he would dump his pods, these napalm tanks. And those are things that just start tumbling, you know, end over end, just start tumbling. You know, I figured, you know, God, it should be a bomb and float, you know, like a football being spiraled towards the ground. But they would just aimlessly tumble towards the ground, and then all of a sudden, Jesus Christ, boy, it looked like the whole world was on fire there for a while. They dumped a bunch up there. In addition, you know, to his napalm drop, you'd always hear it, the aircraft itself, he'd have his 20mm cannons working, or his 50 calibers working, you know, but he'd be shooting at something. You'd hear a clacking, that'd be his old 50 calibers working, or 20mm.
They were used against the trench lines and other?
Yes, you know, and even the napalm didn't get them all out of those damn bunkers. And I saw one of our POWs that we captured. He had a napalm burn on his back that was about the size. Apparently what had happened is some of the gel had dripped down into his bunker. The blockbusters loosened it up a little bit. Some of it dripped down on him. But he had an area about the size of a pancake that was a burn, and a blister-type burn on his back. And apparently, you know, he tried to... the only reason it was larger is because, you know, when it fell on him, apparently he tried to grab it. If he'd just put his hand over it and left it, I would imagine it'd been okay. But he had a hole, and it was eating into him, and he had... there were maggots down inside of it because he'd been up there for a while. But he'd been burned. And then, you know, you see the real effect of what napalm does is the bloated, charred, black bodies. Just, you know, you see bodies with no clothing on them and a cartridge belt or something. Tennis shoes were ripped off, burned up, and rubber and everything, just, you know, nothing. And then amongst the people that were, you know, charred up a little bit, there were people that, you know, you wonder, how did they die? You know, I mean, God, they were supposed to have been burned to death by napalm. apparently they just inhaled the flame and it killed them. They were only affected by a flash fire that didn't do that much damage to them, and they looked relatively all right, but they were, they were blackened and dead. And the napalm consequently made up for the large part of smell at Queso, because it has a distinct smell to it, and it turned everything black and brown and stuff. Trees.